a polite reference to a Somali belief that international navies protected illegal fishing boats. I had written about this controversy myself. I had even asked President Aileen for more evidence, documents, photographs. But firm proof was elusive in Somalia, and Aileen had provided us nothing. "Does he know we're not from Atalanta?" I asked Gerlach. "I have explained it to him." "We urgently need support," said Abduela, "both military and economic. The tsunami in 2004 has destroyed our way of life." The Indian Ocean tsunami of 2004 had flooded the coast of Somalia and wrecked a terrible number of houses and fishing boats, whole livelihoods. It had also washed ashore tubs of poisonous waste. Ships run by the Italian mob had dumped many of these tubs off the coast. "We will relay the message," I said. I asked Gerlach in what sense Abduela was the mayor of Hobyo, since two men were vying for the job. "Abduela is not an official mayor. He does not have the government title," he told me, "but he has the respect and support of the clans here in Hobyo. Above all, he has support from the pirates." I nodded. "Where's our mayor, Mohamed Awale?" "His car is making a tour of Hobyo. It's important for him to be seen. He will join us for lunch." Soon he arrived, seeming clumsy and uncertain compared with the flamboyant Abduela. Lunch arrived, too. We had endless piles of spaghetti, steaming sweet tea, whole fried mackerel, and slabs of camel meat. Flies, excited by the food, dive-bombed our lips before we could finish chewing. We batted them away with greasy hands or with Somali flags, but they kept at it. One even landed on my eyeball. I remember thinking the flies in Hobyo were as hungry as the people. Gerlach and Dixie had promised that a pirate would visit for an interview after lunch. For a long time, we sat and swatted flies. Abduela vanished, and poor, uncertain Mohamed Awale told me the name of the pirate boss who owned the mansion with the land cruiser sculpture over the door. "His name is Fatshi." Fatshi, it turned out, had masterminded the capture of the Shifu One. And the name of the pirate we were about to meet? Awale wasn't sure. After another hour, though, a gangling man wearing khakis and a tan-collared shirt, his head wrapped in a red-patterned keffiyeh, stepped through the door. We saw no part of his face beside the bloodshot eyes. He called himself Mustaf Mohammed Sheikh. Ashwin focused his camera and started the interview. Mustaf Mohammed lost no time declaring himself at war with forces of the West. He said that white people had attacked Somalia by trawling its coral reefs and dumping poison on its shores. "As soon as they stop leaving poison on our beaches and taking fish from our seas, we will stop hijacking ships," the pirate said. Some of his complaints were legitimate, but it wasn't rare for a pirate to invoke a cause. Pirates throughout history have piggybacked on social ideals. For example, Klaus Störtebeker, the 14th-century German privateer, named his gang of North Sea bandits the Leichdeliers because they shared their loot and lived by an ethic of cooperation more equitable than the cruel hierarchies of most European ships. The complaints were real, and so was the justice of resistance, but that didn't keep the pirates from murder and rape. What undercut Mustaf Mohammed's speech to us was the sheer number of impoverished sailors captured in Somalia. At the time of our interview, more than 700 hostages from India, Bangladesh, Iran, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Yemen, and the Philippines were still being held in cruel conditions. The affected shipping companies, too, were a random assortment, sometimes Danish or Greek, sometimes Liberian, Malaysian, Chinese. The profiteering had little to do with complaints against the West. Pirates just caught what they could. "Can you swim?" Ashwin asked, and the pirate said, through Gerlach's translation, "Yes." "I have heard that most pirates cannot swim," persisted Ashwin. "But that's an important skill for any pirate," said Mustaf Mohammed. "Someone who works with us should be able to swim. Where did you get this information?" "We had it from the trial in Hamburg. Ashwin had borrowed it from me. One day in court, a Dutch naval captain had described the arrest and transfer of the captured Somalis to his frigate. A young pirate had tried to escape by jumping off the deck." "Could he swim?" the judge had asked. "No," said the Dutch captain, "but that wasn't unusual." And then he uttered one of the few memorable lines of the long and tedious trial. "In my experience," the captain said, "most pirates can't swim." But Mustaf Mohammed lectured us about his pirates' water skills. Most people understand what it takes to be a pirate. Courage, speed in boarding a ship with a ladder or a rope, he said. Above all, a strong will. Those are the criteria. We nodded. It was my turn to ask a question. Would it help if there were piers along the shore of Galmadug, I said, to promote the economy and create jobs? If there were more jobs here, would you stop hijacking ships? When foreigners stop robbing our fish, stop poisoning our water, and leave us in peace, then we will accept limitations, not before. How did your career as a pirate start? I asked. Someone sank my boat, he said. My brother was killed. All our equipment, our nets and everything, were destroyed. That was the beginning. When? 10 years ago. Who did it? I said. Denmark. A Danish ship. A troller. Warm sunlight stifled the room. Flies swirled over the plates of food. The pirate, with his face covered, seeming anxious, fixed me with his unquiet eyes. I have a final question, said Ashwin. Have you ever kidnapped anyone on land? No, we have never kidnapped any innocent person, said Mustaf Mohammed Sheikh. We would never do such a thing. If we did such things, we might kidnap you now. I understand, said Ashwin. Throughout the conversation, one elder whispered to the pirate, as if to feed him lies. It was odd. When Mustaf Mohammed left, as he'd arrived, still wearing his keffiyeh, in a pall of portentous self-regard, Ashwin asked the elder what he'd whispered. The old man shook his head. He says he was not whispering to the pirate, Gerlach translated. Chapter 8 Abduella then presented the Gakayo elders with his bill for lunch. He smiled and vanished again like a Cheshire cat. Dixie, the dignified elder, sat on the floor with his back against the couch and passed the bill up to another man with a look of rueful amusement. I watched the piece of paper move from hand to hand. Abduella's family, the Saads and Hobyo, were sticking it to Gerlach's family, the Saads from Galkayo, or so it was explained to us. For the lunchtime spread, they wanted $620. It was an exorbitant price in any part of the world, but Ashwin and I had paid Gerlach thousands of dollars to organize these 2 weeks in Somalia. We knew that disputes over money could lead to kidnappings, so we paid close attention to this controversy. It seemed to fizzle. The heat and flies continued into the late afternoon. For safety reasons, we had to wait for the right moment to leave. At last we filed out to the cars and drove north from Hobyo along the pirate road. The plan was to spend a night on the coast at Eden, a beach north of Hobyo where Dixie and the other Saads wanted to build another pier. After sundown, we came to a stretch of washboarded mud that rattled under our tires. The caravan slowed. Our driver made a phone call, and three Somalis emerged from bushes along a ridge, holding flashlights. They swung the beams until our car steered into a narrow gap leading through the ridge and down to a camp on the sand. This was Eden. Our shelter consisted of a round thatched roof with a single fat post for support. We unloaded our bags and made ourselves comfortable. Gerlach settled into a plastic chair to smoke a cigarette. It would be nice to spend the end of my life here, he said ruefully. There is an old canning factory up on the cliff. Hamid and I have discussed buying it. If this place was secure, we could turn the factory into a water treatment plant. Somalia will always need bottled water, he sighed. I would like to retire here. Even in the dark, I could sense the allure of this wild coast. Eden had a deep quiet, a spooky sense of wilderness and desolation. A young woman shuffled up in her robe to unlock a door set into the earthen wall. It flipped up to reveal a little shop, no more than a closet, packed with snacks and drinks. The guards crowded around to buy cigarettes. They'd been here before. Outside our shelter, the boss gave soft-spoken orders. He was a middle-aged man called Noor, with a gap in his teeth and an open-collared shirt, who smoked constantly. The skeptical look in his eye, the cigarettes, and his rough beard all reminded me of a friend of my parents. It was a strange association to make in the Somali bush, but it clung to me. Dennis Lyon, the father of Sonia, my kindergarten romance, had the same gravelly voice and the same gap in his teeth. The association was dreamlike and surreal, and had nothing to do with Dennis's character or Noor's, but once I had made it, I thought about Dennis for a long time. He was a hard-bitten but clever engineer, a no-nonsense Lockheed man with a brownish beard, who used to smoke like a chimney and chide his children with good-humored authority. In my father's absence, friends like him had become distant surrogate fathers, the last men from a certain generation to remember me as a kid. When the sun rose in the morning, it revealed a wide cove where a sandstone riverbed led to a freshwater well near the surf. Nomad shepherds moved herds of camels and goats to the well. Gerlach took us for a walk along the beach, and we found a massive industrial waste canister, yellow and almost cube-shaped, 7 or 8 feet tall, sitting in the shore break.
"This washed up in the tsunami," he said. "It is too heavy for anyone to move."
"Where is it from?" I said.
"We don't know."
It looked like radioactive waste canisters I had seen in photographs. Italian journalists had uncovered collusion between 'Ndrangheta mafia bosses and warlords in Somalia to bury tons of waste in Somali soil, or sink it in the waters offshore, during the 90s. This container was similar. I wondered if it would hamper Gerlach's dream of a water treatment plant. We left Eden late in the morning and drove north. Dixie's car ran far ahead of ours. The landscape was still dry and blasted, and after a while it occurred to me that we weren't headed west, toward Galkayo.
"Where are we going?" I asked Gerlach.
"To Garasad,
the next significant pirate town to the north."
"Does Dixie have influence there?"
I asked.
"Not really."
One pirate from the Hamburg trial came from Garasad, but we'd ruled it out as a town to visit. Gerlach had declared it too dangerous.
"Why are we going there?"
I said.
"Dixie wants you to see the horizon," Gerlach said. "He wants Ashwin to film it."
The elder hoped Ashwin would film the empty sea at the same spot where the German reporter had compared the waterline to Amsterdam's. Saad's in Galmudug were solving their problems. Dixie wanted us to know. Pirates weren't flourishing here.
"Ashwin, was this your idea?"
"No."
I didn't like it. We asked the caravan to turn toward home. Gerlach nodded. Our driver cut across hard mud to the west while Dixie's car struggled over some terrain about half a mile ahead. Gerlach dialed Dixie's phone. The normally cheerful elder grew angry. From the other car, he asked us all to stop. We did. A whole line of vehicles stalled in the bush, and Dixie climbed out to argue with Gerlach. They stood under the strengthening sun and bickered in Somali. Hamid translated some of what he heard. "You cannot treat us like children," Dixie said. His honor had been wounded. Ashwin watched the argument in a side-view mirror.
"He is not letting go," he said.
At last, Gerlach came back to our car and sat next to us, looking miffed. He muttered about bowing to an illiterate like Dixie. But he'd won the argument, and our caravan continued to Galkayo.
Chapter 9. After this trip to the coastal wilds, Galkayo seemed bustling and familiar, less menacing and unpredictable. The fear and tension I had felt in Hobyo resolved into a strange feeling of affection for the dusty crossroads town. Hamid said the Garfanji rumors had fizzled, but Ashwin and I made up our minds to leave as soon as possible because of Gerlach's altercation with Dixie. The families of the arrested pirates in Hamburg lived in North Galkayo. I still wanted to talk to them, though it wasn't clear that a tour of the north would be safe. I would try, but I wasn't about to take any more stupid risks. In any case, I would take the next flight to Nairobi. Ashwin was off to Mogadishu, and our flights fell on separate days.
"Mike, how do you feel?" he asked in our room.
"Much better. Do you have enough material?"
I said we would have to see how it went in North Galkayo.
"It does not look promising, to be honest. Sometimes you just have to take what you can get," he said.
"I know. Well, do you want me to stay until you fly out?" he offered. "Or should I take this flight to Mogadishu tomorrow?" The Galkayo airport roads could be dangerous. Two Western aid workers, Jessica Buchanan and Paul Thisted, had been kidnapped on one of them several months before. I didn't like the idea of an extra trip through such a bad stretch of dirt, but Ashwin had nothing to do. He wanted to leave. We talked to Hamid and forged a plan. Hamid knew a man called Robert at the UN who could assemble a strong security detail for an excursion through North Galkayo. The next day, January 21st, a Saturday, I would accompany Ashwin to the airport
and we could meet Robert there. After Ashwin flew off, we could leave for North Galkayo under UN guard. The gunmen would be Dorod clan members from Puntland rather than the Sa'ad guards we'd used until now. It was a reasonable solution. I felt less nervous than before. I even wrote cheerful messages home about the food, the slabs of watermelon, and the wild camel meat. Saturday morning, we woke early and waited for a ride to the airport. Our regular Hobyo guards were supposed to escort us. They failed to show up. After half an hour, Gerlach said, "Now I am starting to worry," and he called President Aline, who sent a white jeep with a single gunman for the airport dash. There was no clear explanation for this switch in security and transportation. I considered staying at the hotel, but the safest place for either of us was wherever Gerlach happened to be. "If you are kidnapped, I will be kidnapped," he had told us more than once, "and if I am kidnapped, there will be war," meaning a flare-up of violence between subclans. The airport road was actually two or three trails winding out of Galkayo through an arid, boulder-littered landscape. The piles of dusty rock were traditional Sufi graves, and they memorialized Galkayo residents killed in the long civil war. A Somali sat in a chair beside the airport gate, which wasn't a gate, but just a rickety steel barrier, a piece of junk in the dust. The Galkayo airport had strict rules against weapons in this nation lousy with guns, and he demanded our guard's rifle. The airport was still closed, he said. We were too early. After a moment, he accepted a $1 bribe to move the piece of junk and let us park beside the terminal. The chalk-white building had the lassitude of a lonely bus terminal, and it was, in fact, closed tight. The rising sun cast a fresh young light across the airstrip, and a patio had a number of plastic chairs and some words painted on the wall, suggesting that a shuttered window might open soon for refreshments. When it did, we bought glasses of tea. Other Somalis came to settle in chairs and wait. Hamid's phone rang. Robert, the UN man, had bad news. "He says his security team will not make the appointment," said Hamid. "Let me talk to him." Robert, who spoke European-accented English, sounded gentle and concerned. He had to apologize. His security team had an urgent job somewhere else. He'd been doing Hamid a favor. He wasn't contracted to help. "We won't make it to North Galkayo today," I told Hamid. "We can't do it with the security we have." "Maybe tomorrow," he agreed, and lit a cigarette. The tense prospect of a visit to North Galkayo had eased, but now we had just a single guard in the president's jeep for the trip back to our hotel. I blinked away a bad intuition and took a sip of tea. Hamid asked for my email address. I gave him a card from Spiegel Online. He read my name out loud, and a fat young Somali at a neighboring table glanced over. "You are Michael Scott Moore?" "Yes." "I have seen you on the internet," he said. "You are famous." I wrinkled my forehead. "No, I'm not." Alarm bells should have been ringing in my head. Whispers had swept the rumor kitchen. I felt a mild wash of dread from this weird conversation, but by now it was far too late. Ashwin's plane landed after a long delay, and we shook hands with him on a square of tarmac beside the airstrip. We started back to our hotel in President Aline's car. It was midday, and the sun glared on the rocky graves. Other cars wound behind us. But soon our driver slowed and made a careful remark in Somali. "Technical," Gerlach translated. "We don't know what kind." I didn't see it at first. The battle wagon stood to the left of the road, loaded with drowsy-looking men. "Can we just drive on?" I said. Gerlach said, "It is one of ours." I saw the words Kibir Jabiye on the technical and felt a moment of relief. A car honked. The technical jerked to life. I had not flown to Somalia to test my nerve against the worst fears of a foreign correspondent. I didn't want to tempt death, but I had broken one of the cardinal rules of anyone who pokes around in troublesome parts of the world, which is to keep your family's lives unaffected. The horror of crossing that line wasn't evident to me when the technical approached the car, with its cannon aimed through our windshield. It wasn't even clear when a dozen or so men jumped off, holding weapons. It wasn't clear because my brain recoiled in denial. I told myself it was a traffic stop. These armed clan soldiers just wanted to see my passport. No problem. My German passport was here in my bag. I had never witnessed denial working in my own head with so much specific clarity, but it moved like a gyroscope, compensating for a drastic blow that hadn't even arrived, to maintain some balance. And when the gunman swarmed to my side of the car and fired into the air, the balance wobbled and my bowels twisted, and I understood very well what the fuck was going on. I leaned against Gerlach to cover my face with one arm, as if that would help. When I turned out to be alive in spite of the thunder of gunfire, I held the door closed with my right hand. They wrenched it open and pounded my wrist with their Kalashnikovs. I had never felt so much violent malice at such close range, and I kept pulling at the door, hoping to buy time while our guard in the front seat performed his job. I was confused by the number of men who kept pounding my wrist with their gun barrels. I felt bones crack. I let go of the door, and they pulled me into the dust outside and beat me on the head. Maybe death arrives with the same sudden malice, the same transformative shock. I noticed a lack of gunfire from our guard. He must have quailed at the sight of the cannon. "Somebody help me!" I shouted while a man slugged my face and broke my glasses in the dust. "Somebody help me!" Of course, nobody did. Somalis in the cars behind us, respectful of the violence, just watched. Gunmen pulled at my arms and ripped my shirt. I heard Gerlach shout. I couldn't tell whether kidnappers had subdued him in the car or pulled him into the road, whether this abduction was about to spark a clan war. I was only aware of gunmen, shouted Somali, and white dust. I struggled. The kidnappers pulled my backpack away, and I noticed blood on my clothes from the gun muzzles clobbering my scalp. My wrist ached, and I tried to see faces, to recognize any of the kidnappers from our Hobyo guards, but in the blur of kicks and rifle blows, nobody looked familiar. The horror of crossing that bright, clear line drenched me like a cloudburst, like blood and sweat, and I wanted to rewind everything. While they dragged me away, I felt a reflexive horror for my family and the burden I was about to become. The men bundled me into a waiting Land Cruiser and drove me to a house on the edge of Galkayo. One of them handed my backpack to a tall and furious-looking man in the driveway. He took the bag but waved us off. We sped away to the east, and I sat with ripped clothes and a bleeding scalp, squeezed by three gunmen, bouncing across the bush for several hours. "Okay, okay," the pirates in the front seat said. "No problem." The car bounced brutally over a ledge, so my head hit the roof and left a bloodstain on the fabric. "Fuck," I said, and pointed at the blood, cradling the broken wrist in my lap. At first, I spoke mainly in obscenities. "Okay, okay," they said. Part 2. Underworld. Chapter 1. Near sundown, we arrived at an outdoor camp in a reddish, sandy part of the bush. The pirates walked me to a foam mattress waiting at the foot of a squat and crumbling cliff. My torn shirt dangled from me like a scarecrow's. I was half blind and still delirious, but I could make out other Somali gunmen and other hostages. The sun sank behind us. We had driven from that direction, which meant Galkayo lay to the west. We hadn't shifted very far north or south from what I could tell in the car. So, by a rough guess, we were in northeastern Galmudug, Sa'ad territory. "Okay, Michael," one guard said. This earnest young Somali wore a turban around his head and stood on a rise with his Kalashnikov, and the marbled sky behind him had thin swirls of reddish cloud. "No," I said after a while. I squinted at each guard to see if I recognized anyone from our hired team. They weren't the same men, but if they were Sa'ad pirates, it didn't matter. My hosts had betrayed me. Sa'ads had promised to protect me. A Sa'ad somewhere had turned. The men from the Land Cruiser mingled with the other guards. One sloped around with an ammunition vest dangling from his shoulders. His face looked half-melted with anger. He had rotten teeth and stained-looking eyes. The others called him Ahmed Dirye. Another name I heard over and over was Abdinur, normally pronounced with an exclamation point. "Abdinur!" My body felt battered and tense, but for some reason I thought about my backpack. I was still fresh enough as a hostage to care about my things, like a man who'd lost his head and wanted to put it back on. "They took my bag," I told the young guard. "Can you ask someone for my bag? It's a maroon backpack with a camera in it." "They steal your camera?" "Yes. Thieves,
he blurted. I looked at him curiously. One very dark, very thin Somali came to squat near me with a bottle of water, a can of tuna, and two narrow loaves of bread. I tried to eat. I noticed dried blood on my hands and shirt. There must have been blood in my hair. My wrist throbbed, and when I inspected it tenderly, I felt pieces of bone moving around. The watchful silence in the camp made an eerie counterpoint to my ferocious instinct to be free. My still intact sense of self, the energetic part that identified with possessions, habits, achievements, needs, protested in panic. "You can't do this," it wanted to say. But of course they could. The sun set. Everything blurred without my glasses, and after an hour we all sat around in the pitch black, wholly blind, at the base of our sandstone cliff, which sometimes dropped bits of sand on our shoulders. I continued to sit straight up on my mattress, blinking. The pirates wanted me to sleep. One of them, on my left, lanced a flashlight beam into my eyes. He expected me to lie back so he could have a conversation with Ahmed Dirye on my right. "Sleeping! Sleeping!" he said, and in the dark I offered him a middle finger. "If I'm in the way," I thought, "you can damn well set me free." This part of the bush was arid savanna, a parching transition zone between the ocean and the Ogaden Desert, which stretched north and west into Ethiopia. The landscape had a blanket of hush. But the deep peace of the countryside felt as harrowing as my capture. The pure distance from my family, the stir of commotion this crime would cause at home, in Los Angeles and among my friends in Berlin, set up a quiet, drumming dread. Now I belonged to an underworld of captives who radiated rumors, like the whispers of ghosts, into the more ordinary world. I wondered if Ashwin had called anyone. If Gerlach was free and alive, he would have called Ashwin by now in Mogadishu, and Ashwin had my mother's number in California. Had Gerlach been captured? Or Hamid? Was there some kind of war now between subclans of Saads? Or had my fixers sold me out? Somehow I must have slept. After the sun rose in the morning, the pirates stuffed me into the rear seat of a car next to a pair of other hostages, both in their 60s. One looked African, but the other was hard to make out. He had cocoa-colored skin and twin furzes of gray hair sticking out over his ears, like a Pacific Islander. This was Raleigh Tambara. We were about to become excellent friends. Armed pirates crammed in beside us and tied our arms together. Ahmed Dirye gave orders from the passenger seat. His melted-seeming face and rotten teeth were heavy with melancholic rage. The car was the same as yesterday's, I noticed. It had the bloodstain from my scalp. After half an hour of cruising and swaying along the pirate road, a second car overtook us. We stopped in the soft white sand. The pirates said, "Go, go, go, go," expecting us to cram into the second car. The orders confused us. A tall Somali from the other car, who had an authoritative squint, and wore a half-buttoned dress shirt, hollered, "Come on, come on," as if we weren't moving fast enough. While I ducked into the other car, he hit me hard alongside the head. "No," he said, as if I had misbehaved. "No, no." "Fucking hell," I said. This man appeared at our window and said to me, in clear English, "We know about your activities as a journalist, but it is okay. If you can pay the ransom, you will go free." Then he climbed into the first Land Cruiser and sped off. We continued south for almost an hour, but finally steered into the walled compound of some filthy, decrepit house, where the pirates led the two hostages through a doorway and hustled me into the neighboring room. Bare, blue-painted concrete, shuttered windows. I sat on the floor. Hard to tell where we were. This house lay on the edge of the first town we had met coming south along the pirate road, either Hobyo or Hardhere. Some of the guards had yelled, "Haradiri," into their phones. I squinted and tried to bring the yard into focus. At least 20 Somalis lazed on the sunlit concrete with their Kalashnikov rifles and tripoded machine guns chewing cot. Flies flurried near my doorway. Judging by the flies, I thought, we were in Hobyo. Ahmed Dirye dumped my mattress on the floor. Other Somalis carried in a tall thermos of tea and a few cans of tuna. One handed me a packet of instant coffee and a small plastic strainer. "Café," he said with a smile. His enthusiasm was infectious. I love coffee, but he mimed pouring the tea through the strainer, which made no sense. At home, I had a cheap espresso machine that coughed and gasped and filled my kitchen with the smell of steam-pressed coffee every morning. I was a snob about it. Otherwise, I led an unostentatious life. No car, simple furniture, no TV, and, of course, when I traveled, I could tolerate all kinds of thin and miserable, warmed-over jus de chasseur, or sock juice. But at home, I drank good coffee. I missed it in Somalia, not from my first day in the country, but from my first day as a hostage. Another pirate slid a bowl of cooked brown beans onto the floor of my room. I was hungry but still nauseated by the new conditions. Someone handed me a spoon. I ate in silence, flicking away flies. The yard outside my door included a round concrete well and a number of dusty tires. The steam rising from my pot of food seemed to distill an odor of shit or stagnant water that permeated the compound. The beans must have been cooked with well water. This idea churned my stomach, and after a few bites, I retched and puked on the steps. "Problem," the pirates said. They had trouble finding a rag to clean the mess. They shouted and scowled. Flashlight man gaped at me from the yard, the way a zoo visitor might watch a dromedary. I hoped he understood that the vomit had been a commentary on my new status as a hostage, as well as a criticism of the food. After an hour, a smooth-looking man came in, wearing slacks. He introduced himself as a translator. I learned later that his name was Boudin, but he never said so. Instead, he offered warnings and condescending wisdom. I had made a mistake, he said. Mistakes were human. I should not open the windows. An armed guard waited outside every wall. If you open a window, he said, you will die. You must eat, he advised me. If you don't eat, you will die. The food is disgusting. What would you like to eat for breakfast? I don't know, I said. Maybe oatmeal. You must eat. He had a lean face with busy eyes. His loose Western clothes gave him status compared with the guards, who wore a slouching, half-traditional uniform of sleeveless T-shirts and skirt-like sarongs. Boudin was about 30, but hard to pin down. He seemed nervous and twitchy. By now I had tied a sling around my wrist made from a piece of cloth, which he noticed with some concern. What is wrong with your hand? It's broken, I said. The wrist is broken. I need a doctor. You mean it was broken in this operation? He said, gesturing vaguely out the door. No, motherfucker, I'm in the habit of walking around Somalia with a broken wrist. Yes, is how I chose to phrase it. I will submit your request. Chapter 2. It was an interesting sentiment to hear from a man who stood to grow rich on my ransom. You have made a mistake, he said. Mistakes are human. Clearly I had fucked up, but from Boudin's point of view, what could have been my mistake? He must have meant journalism, nosing around in a pirate gang's business. But Saad pirates had little to do with the Taipan. Most of the pirates in Hamburg were Darod, from Puntland, rivals to my supposed hosts. I hadn't even made it to North Galkayo to research that part of the story. So, I thought, squinting out at the shadows of Somalis chewing cot in the yard, what had I done to threaten these men? Boudin referred to a bad group, meaning the men who'd kidnapped me. He insisted that the guards holding me now were the good group, as if I ought to be nice to them. In spite of my blurred eyesight, I could spot at least one of my captors lazing in the yard. The slouching, rage-addled Somali called Ahmed Dirye relaxed in a yellow sarong next to a tripodded machine gun. I scowled at Boudin. He wasn't even a good liar. What's your name? I said. Ali. But the real Ali, the Ali who mattered, was Ali Dulai, who'd slugged me on the pirate road. I learned his name later. He paid two visits to the house, and at first I recognized him only as a tall and menacing figure who stood, like a taciturn soldier, in the bright doorway and came in to ask questions in slow and broken English. He was middle-aged and well-built. He wore khakis and collared shirts as well as his Kalashnikov. He squatted in front of my mattress on the first visit and inspected my swollen wrist. His mind moved to other things. You are German? My German passport was in my bag, I said. You have my bag. I thought he might be the man who'd received my backpack in front of the house in Galkayo. If I wanted my things, maybe he was the man to ask.
I copped a sudden attitude with Ali Dulai, an air of ownership and expectation at odds with my new role.
You took my backpack, I babbled. Someone has my backpack. Bring it here. It has phone numbers. I need to make a telephone call.
Someone should bring my backpack here with all my notebooks. They have phone numbers, that kind of thing.
He stared at me with hard, unblinking eyes.
You are also American.
I'm a German citizen, I insisted.
He stood up to leave. I will send a doctor.
I'd left my U.S. passport in Nairobi, along with a laptop and other important things.
I had not wanted to alarm Galmudug officials with an American passport when I landed in Galkayo. I'd wanted to pass as European. But Dulai could have Googled my name, and if news outlets had reported my kidnapping, he could have read every word.
You have made a mistake, Budin had said. Mistakes are human.
The guards handed me toothpaste, a towel, shampoo, and an assortment of mango drinks, as well as some plastic-wrapped shirts and shorts. They ordered me to change out of my bloodied clothes, the old long-sleeved shirt and cotton slacks, which were torn but still comfortable, so tossing them into a pile for the pirates to dispose of raised feelings of panic and loss. There was nothing wrong with my previous clothes. There was nothing wrong with my previous life. The sense of waste was sickening. The new clothes felt too tight. I changed awkwardly, gingerly, without the benefit of a button-down shirt. I stuffed my wrist through a tight polyester sleeve. The guards watched me dress. Then one of them ordered me out to the shower.
Now?
I just put this on.
Now, come on.
Can't it wait?
Go.
So at gunpoint, holding a new bottle of shampoo, I picked my way across the filthy compound yard. The pirates watched me with curious loathing. The shower was just a walled-off corner open to the sky with a pit toilet. One gunman handed a jerry can full of water past the sagging metal door. While he waited, I undressed and threw the fresh clothes across the top of the dusty wall, which had ornamented breeze blocks I could squint through. I saw the blur of an unpaved road and a few distant, impressionistic white houses. Beyond a couple of yards, without my glasses, everything looked like Monet. Also bushes and a seaside horizon. Robed women and goats wandered along the road. None of it helped orient me. None of it told me where to run. I used my left arm to lift the jerry can and dump water on my head. Probably well water. I tried to avoid my face. I lathered everything with shampoo and rinsed myself in careful slops. It was a nice evening, I noticed. The sun was going down. And in the distance, I heard Somali children sing.
Chapter 3. From such a remote corner of the world, I found it hard to imagine what my mom in California had learned, or how she'd learned it. But the chain of information was swift. Gerlach had called Ashwin, who had called U.S. and German authorities from Mogadishu, and FBI headquarters in Washington had mustered 5 agents in southwestern L.A. County within 12 hours of my capture. My mother was 72 at the time, spry, with glasses and a sweet, beaming smile, and her retirement was less than relaxing, as far as I could tell from Berlin. She kept up a bruising schedule of tennis and golf. Her first name, Marlis, was a German contraction of Maria Elizabeth, and her last name, Saunders, had changed with her second marriage. Her husband, Lou, had retired from an aerospace firm called TRW, later absorbed by Northrop Grumman. They lived in a townhouse in a suburban grid built in the 50s and 60s to shelter TRW engineers and middle managers. The sprawling, sun-beaten beach cities of Los Angeles had grown rich since the 70s, but my mother's condominium was stuck in time. She had been sitting and reading a newspaper at home when 5 people in suits climbed out of a nondescript American sedan by the curb. The strangers roused her curiosity. It was about noon on a winter Saturday, and on Saturdays in Redondo Beach, people didn't walk around in suits. Family friends were due at the door any minute. She was looking forward to lunch at a Mexican restaurant. Through a window, she saw the 5 suits clustered on the porch, and she opened up. One of them flashed a badge.
Mrs. Saunders?
Yes. When I saw their badges, she said later, my heart just dropped. It was the worst day of my life.
The FBI investigates any major crime against an American at home or overseas. The German Bundeskriminalamt, or BKA, also investigates crimes against Germans. So agents from the BKA appeared at my uncle's door in Cologne. More BKA agents went to the Spiegel office in Berlin. FBI agents also visited the Pulitzer Center in Washington, D.C., and in every case, they gave instructions on how to react. Basically, they told us how to keep calm in case a pirate put you on the phone and threatened to cut your fingers off, said Charles Hawley, a colleague and friend at Spiegel Online. Mom's townhouse became a hive of federal activity. The agents wanted to know about my trip, about Ashwin and Gerlach, about my acquaintances and friends. They wanted to tap the landline. They told Mom what to say in case a pirate called. They tried to ease her mind by saying my kidnappers just wanted cash, not a dead hostage. Mom spent the afternoon in a blurred state of shock. Their blackberries were going like crazy, she remembered. I had no idea so many federal agents lived around here. Meanwhile, her friends arrived for lunch. A crowd of Germans and Americans from my parents' distant past descended on the condominium from various parts of L.A. Dennis and Sylvia and Hildy arrived, and they were all shocked, my mother said. They didn't even come in the house. Hildy was a friend of the family. Dennis Lyon was the bearded and gravel-voiced man who'd been on my mind any din. It surprised his wife Sylvia to see Mom at the door with a tear-stained face. "Your mother came to the door and told us what happened," she said. "Then two FBI agents came to the door and said, 'We'd prefer if you didn't come in right now.'" And Dennis said, "We better go outside." I hadn't seen Dennis or Sylvia or any of our old friends in years. They belonged to my earliest memories. Nevertheless, it strikes me as a weird coincidence that Dennis had a peripheral presence around my kidnapping in both parts of the world, not just on my mind in Somalia, but in front of my mother's door. "My dad was extremely concerned about you and devoured every piece of information he could find," said his daughter Sonia, much later. "We talked about you often, and one of the many times when I asked him what could be done to get you out, he simply said, 'I don't have an answer for that kid. Michael is stuck between a rock and a hard place.'" Chapter 4. The next morning, at the filthy house, I noticed a difference in my inventory of things. Someone had delivered a case of bottled water and a tub of dry oatmeal, but a bottle of mango juice was missing. While I sat up on my mattress and thought about how to eat the oatmeal, a furtive pirate squinted into my room.
"Where are?" he said. "Mango!
Hmm?
Give me mango."
"Why?"
"Mango! Mango!"
One of the drinks was an oversweet mango soda, which looked unpleasant, so I handed it over. The man disappeared without a word. I felt affronted. Why would a pirate bum a drink? The pirates gave me drinks. I had no source for food or drink besides pirates. Another hostage came out of the next door room and went to the toilet. I caught him speaking a broken, maritime-sounding English. He still had twin frizzes of hair over his ears. The guards found him comical and called him Lori. He asked for a haircut, and when I caught a glimpse of him again, he had short-clipped hair and looked almost dapper. The maritime sound of his English made me think he was a merchant sailor, or else raised on some island with a British colonial past, or both. He ducked into his room without glancing at me. I sat on my mattress and started to crave both coffee and oatmeal. But when I bothered a pirate for boiled water, he didn't seem to understand. "Café," he said with enthusiasm, and pointed at my thermos. I shook my head. The thermos was full of tea. Evidently, I was a stupid hostage. The guard stalked over to open a packet of instant coffee and dump the black dust into my plastic strainer. He motioned for me to hold it over my cup, then poured hot tea through. The resulting liquid was muddy, cloying, molasses-like, but heavily caffeinated. "That is disgusting," I declared. "Café," insisted the Somali. "It is not." I sat there with my weird beverage and reflected on the continuing problem of oatmeal. I didn't want it cooked with water from the well, but if I could coax a guard to boil some bottled water, we might get somewhere. Flashlight Man strolled into my room and opened the rusted shutters on the window Boudin had ordered me not to open. I cringed and waited for gunfire. Instead, a lively conversation developed between the pirate and the guard outside. The window itself had no glass, I noticed, but a fixed, florid-looking metal screen. inconvenient for escapes. When the conversation ended, Flashlight Man left the shutters open, as if he'd never heard of Budin's order to keep them closed, and on his way out the door, he stooped to pick up my canister of oatmeal.
"Hey," I said, and my raised voice upset the Somalis. "What is the problem?"
one of them said. Sudden outrage stiffened the hairs on my neck.
"That guy stole my oatmeal."
The Somali smiled sympathetically, as if I had again failed to understand.
"Oatmeal should be in the kitchen," he said. "It's better that way."
"Why?" No one could answer my question. I thought the paradox was clear. The pirates gave me the fucking oatmeal. Why would one of them steal it? The calamity of my abduction on a remote edge of the world expressed itself in minor irritations, and "a pirate stole my oatmeal" became an obsessive chant in my head. A pirate stole my oatmeal. A pirate stole my oatmeal. That evening, Ahmed Diriye came into the room with a plastic-wrapped mosquito tent, which the boss must have ordered, to keep me malaria-free. The net baffled Ahmed Diriye. I had the dubious pleasure of watching him and one other Somali pull out the flexible sectioned tent posts, assemble them, try to stuff the lances through the loops in the net, and fail. Ahmed Diriye and the other guards were too looped on cot by this point in the day, or just too thick, to perform such a delicate operation. They left the net in a pile. One of the rods had broken, and eventually someone cleared it away.
"You have made a mistake," Budin had said. "Mistakes are human."
A pirate stole my oatmeal. I spent 3 or 4 days in this anxious and stricken and irritated state before Budin escorted a new man in, hours after sundown. An unarmed, older Somali with a small, peppery beard and a patient, intelligent manner.
"He is a doctor," Budin said.
By the dismal light of a fluorescent lantern, I unwrapped my improvised sling. My wrist had swollen. I could still feel shifting, clacking scraps of bone. The doctor's eyes moved from Budin to me to Ahmed Diriye, who stood in the door. He was a different sort of person from the pirates, a man with a conscience, to judge from his harrowed face, and he seemed uncertain, if not afraid.
"It is not broken," he said after a brief examination. "It is only cracked, and it will heal in 3 weeks."
From a bag of utensils, he produced a splint made of bamboo strips and faded purple cloth. He sewed it onto my wrist with a needle, biting the thread to cut it free. I appreciated the handiwork, though it seemed like a lot of painstaking effort for a treatment that would help so little. I was in no position to argue, but my wrist was broken. I fell asleep with the splinted wrist across my chest. I woke up again in the dark to the clang of the compound door. A car pulled in and rumbled. Much later, I would get used to a pattern of switching houses at night, but I understood without being told that an engine idling in darkness was a bad omen. My heart began to pound. Soon the men hustled me into the crowded Land Cruiser, where only one other hostage, Lori, sat watching the young pirates with a grandfatherly look of disgust. Ahmed Diriye sat in the passenger seat and grinned. Other pirates squeezed in around us with their weapons, acting panicky, and before the sun rose, we drove far into the bush, without any clear destination. When the sun was high, Ahmed Diriye pointed at the sky and spoke to me in rapid Somali. They were upset about a plane or something in the air.
"Are you a Marine General?"
Ahmed Diriye's driver suddenly demanded.
"What?
No.
Colonel?
No."
Whatever had happened, they held me accountable. They thought I was U.S. military. Full of panicked emotion, they told me something urgent in Somali, sprinkled with incomprehensible English.
"Helicopters," Ahmed Diriye said. "American."
All I understood was that a dozen people had died in some distant place.
"Oh, boy," I said. "Boom, boom? Fighting?"
"Yes."
U.S. forces rarely operated inside Somalia. Ever since the Battle of Mogadishu, the military had kept ground missions here to a minimum. I shrugged and figured the pirates were just repeating a crazy rumor. The excitement subsided, and we drove at random across the desert bush for the rest of the morning, sometimes, for some reason, in circles.
Chapter 5
4 days after my capture, a posse of American helicopters rescued the two kidnapped aid workers, Jessica Buchanan and Paul Thisted, from a bush camp south of Galkayo. They were sleeping in the open, surrounded by Somali foot soldiers. A team of Navy SEALs parachuted some distance from the camp and marched up quietly with rifles. They shot 9 sleeping guards and hustled Buchanan and Thisted away to a helicopter. That evening, my mother watched a State of the Union address on TV. Cameras showed President Obama's entourage entering the House chamber. "Obama marched in," said Mom, "and as usual, he shook everybody's hand. He came to Leon Panetta, who was Secretary of Defense. The camera was focused on them, and usually they don't record any of the conversations, but when he came to Leon Panetta, he stopped and said, 'Good job tonight.' He kept shaking his hand and said, 'Really good job tonight.' Nobody knew what that was about. But the next morning it came out that Buchanan was rescued." The leap of hope my mother felt at the news wilted into disappointment that I wasn't among the rescued hostages. Her circle of golf and tennis friends, athletic Republican ladies, dry-humored retirees, wondered out loud whether the SEALs would do it again. "My friends all called," Mom said, "and they told me, if anything happens to Michael, it's going to be Obama's fault." The rescue came early in the morning on January 25th, 2012. FBI agents assigned to my case discussed it with Mom, but only in general terms. "They never said it, but I think rescuing you was always in their sights," she said. "Of course, it had to go through the White House. No one could orchestrate a rescue without Obama's okay." Thisted was Danish. Buchanan was American. They'd both worked in the calm northern province of Somaliland for the Danish Demining Group, a European nonprofit dedicated to pulling up live mines. I'd learned little else before I went to Somalia, why they went to Galmudug, exactly who had captured them, and as a hostage, I heard nothing about their rescue right away. All I knew in Somalia was that America's military presence on the Horn of Africa had less to do with pirates than with tracking al-Shabaab. The Buchanan rescue was therefore a promising sign. It showed that Obama would send a team to Somalia for a humble pirate hostage, even with European powers involved. It showed leadership. "The United States will not tolerate the abduction of our people," Obama said after his State of the Union address. "We will spare no effort to secure the safety of our citizens and to bring their captors to justice." Chapter 6. My fellow hostage had small eyes and a bald pate over his trimmed hedge of gray hair. His skin was coffee brown rather than black, and I still couldn't place his nationality, although I learned his full name, Raleigh Tambara. Every time I asked where he came from, he lifted a knotty, twisted finger to his lips. I gathered that he and his now-missing friend were seafarers, but the vessel he named, the Aride, left me clueless. Around sundown that evening, we found an empty spot on the savannah to meet a second car, which delivered piles of cot and plastic bags full of cooked pasta. The pirates laid a mat in the dust beside our land cruiser. We were supposed to relax, but my wrist hurt and I had no idea where we were headed. All I wanted to do was get there. I still lived in a world of logic and purpose and resolve, and I hadn't figured out how much pointlessness a hostage has to put up with. The hard and dusty savanna stretched in every direction. We saw nothing taller than white thorn bushes and windswept acacias, but the sun went down in magnificent silence, infesting the whole lunar landscape with a soft red glow. "Where's your friend?" I mumbled to Raleigh. He shrugged. "I not know. They leave him behind." "In the house? Yeah." Now his accent sounded French. I asked another question, but Raleigh raised his finger. "Wrong time to talk." After sunset, we piled into the Land Rover again and set off into wooded highlands. The car pounded and rocked on the trail for several hours, and we had to listen to Somali folk music blaring on the stereo. It had a stark, twanging, mournful sound I might have enjoyed in different circumstances. For now, it was the sound of oppression. In the dark wooded hills, we sometimes came to a steel bar blocking the road, a gate of some kind, so the driver had to lean on the horn until a group of graceful women in robes emerged to open the gate and sweep away dust in front of us with hand brooms. It felt dreamlike and strange, since women were already so rare. This world of cot-chewing pirates was almost entirely male. At last we came to a ridge road overlooking a valley. Gunfire flashed and boomed in the distance. We slowed until a car overtook us, and soon Ali Dulai leaned in to glare through a window with his flashlight and give terse orders in Somali. Raleigh and I had to get out and walk through a nearby thicket of thorn bushes. "Where are we going?" demanded Raleigh, because no one seemed to have the slightest idea. Ahmed Diriye just muttered, "Go, go, go, go," and later I would refer to these bushes as the Garden of Pointless Torture. At the exit to the garden, our car waited for us. We climbed in, bleeding slightly. Dulai appeared with two gunmen to deal some more abuse. He ordered Ahmed Diriye to step out, and between the vehicles he hollered and beat Ahmed Diriye with a stick. His henchmen blasted two deafening, flashing rounds into the air, and we saw Ahmed Diriye's form buckle between the cars. He panted in pain while Dulai ordered us to step outside. He examined our faces using the flashlight. He must not have liked the look on mine, because with no explanation he clubbed the side of my head with his fist, and my eyes bloomed with floating light. "Motherfucker!" I hissed. Dulai, satisfied, climbed into our car with his men and drove off. The pirates forced us to march down a bluff along a cliffside trail. Pale moonlight revealed some kind of wooded valley, but we stopped at a shallow cave in the cliff wall where two men dropped our foam mattresses. My ear still rang from the blow, and I must have shivered from the damp or from raw nerves, because a skinny, gentle Somali said, "Michael, no sleep?" "No blanket," I explained. He happened to be wearing a leather bomber jacket. He slipped out of it in the dark and let me sleep in it. I don't know how I lost consciousness that night, after such a long and evil day, but I didn't open my eyes again until a warm light had started to creep across the valley. Chapter 7 Raleigh, flat on his back, was awake. When I sat up, he said,
"What's the matter?"
"I have to go to the bathroom."
"Piss?"
he said kindly.
"Oh, shit."
"Piss."
"It's called Kadi."
He addressed the guards.
"Hey!"
he pointed at me.
"Kadi! Kadi!"
One of the guards led me up a narrow trail to a pile of trash, gestured at it, and wandered a little farther to post himself with his Kalashnikov and gaze across the valley. We stood on a crumbling bluff that overlooked a gorge in the dry savanna, filled with dusty trees. Two pirates carried our mattresses down the hill, and we followed, picking our way through green bushes and white thorn branches. We settled under a bower of trees at the bottom of the valley, and the pirates made a production of filling in gaps around us with white thorn brambles.
"Korax,"
they said, and pointed at the sun as if they wanted us to be comfortable and cool. But no sun streamed in from that direction. It crossed my mind that the obsession with shade, as well as all the hysterical driving around, owed itself to a fear of drones. The skinny pirate didn't ask for his coat back. I fingered the sleeve. Not bad quality. The leather was soft, the elastic cuffs were thick and firm.
"Ah, Angelo give you this jacket?"
said Raleigh.
"Who?"
"That Somali.
Angelo,"
he said, pronouncing the name for me.
"I see he give you this jacket last night. He give you food that day you arrive," he added, "in the desert."
I must have looked confused.
"We send over the tuna and bread. Angelo bring it for you."
"Oh.
He's a good man, eh?"
Pirates had captured Raleigh and his friend Mark Sanguar 3 months earlier, in November 2011, about 50 miles from Mahé, the main island of the Seychelles. They were cleaning fish in Raleigh's boat by night when a skiff approached under a crackle of gunfire. The Seychelles are African islands scattered around the Indian Ocean north of Madagascar, and Mahé lies more than 800 miles from Somalia. Their trip to Hobyo at gunpoint took 7 days. But the pirates thought Raleigh was too light-skinned to be African.
"Seychelles, you know, is many islands," he said. "We are mixed, mixed, mixed. Me? I am part Chinese."
The looniness of the pirates still astounded him. They had read the rear of his little boat, Aride, Port Victoria, and put the letters together in some dyslexic way that led them to accuse Raleigh of being Australian. Maybe they thought an Australian hostage could bring higher ransom. One pirate liked this idea so much that he aimed a rifle at Mark's chest on the boat and ordered him to make an out loud declaration demanding to hear that Raleigh was indeed Australian. But Mark spoke only Seychellois Creole. He said nothing. The pirate took it for insolence and pulled the trigger. The detonation of a blank charge in his AK-47 left the old fisherman quivering for the rest of the day.
"After," said Raleigh, "when they bring us to Somalia, you know, they torture him."
"What?"
"Yeah, Mark, when they ask him to call his family, he not understand. The pirates, they take the battery from my boat. They put
cables.
He patted each arm to show where they had clamped the cables.
And they electrocute him like that.
I winced.
At first he cannot eat.
Mark had lost the use of his arms. So I have to take his fork and feed him, like a child. A dread settled on my chest and wouldn't move.
Jesus, I said. These men are crazy, he said with a shrug. We are like the devil. They are like God, Michael. You can't tell them nothing.